Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, what's next in the fight over abortion access? The Supreme Court's decision that overruled Roe v. Wade transferred power to regulate abortion to the states. We've already seen the procedure banned in 8 and severely restricted in several others. But my guest, Rachel Rebouchet, says the most restrictive measures are yet to come. She is a law professor and interim dean at Temple University's School of Law. She's tracked the patchwork of legislation introduced by states across the country that cover things like medical abortions, the right to travel, and fetal personhood bills. She says the impact of these new laws would stretch far beyond the issue of abortion and would generate a flurry of lawsuits that could once again reach the Supreme Court. Rachel, can you start by giving us a summary of how many states have now restricted or banned abortion since the Dobbs decision?
So what we anticipated with Dobbs was that 26 states would ban abortion, restrict it before viability. And that number, you know, keeps changing. So just yesterday, Georgia went from a state that didn't ban abortion before viability to a state that now today, this morning, does at 6 weeks and recognizes the fetus as a person, according to the law that the 11th Circuit decided should be in force. So it's a rapidly changing legal landscape.
So in a recent piece in The Atlantic, you made the point that this wave of restrictions is just the beginning. What do you mean?
I think that after the wave of banning abortions in roughly half the country, we should expect to see some of those same states enact laws that protect the fetus from the moment of conception. So grant certain rights, certain legal standing, certain recognition to fetal life. I think that we will probably see states start to target patients who, and people who assist patients rather than just providers. Right now, laws target providers. But I think as medication abortion proliferates, the pills that one can take to end a pregnancy before 10 weeks, I think we'll see states start to target patients. I think that the end goal of the anti-abortion movement is to ban abortion everywhere. And what gets it closer to that goal, that's the kind of legislation we should expect to see.
Let's take these things one at a time, because currently there is a great patchwork of laws. One of the big questions is about crossing state lines to access abortions. Where does that now stand?
Currently, laws concentrate within their borders, like typical abortion regulations. States are banning abortion, Texas, for instance, for abortion that's in Texas. But we already see hints of these cross-border laws. We already see that those initiatives bubbling up. So in Texas, for instance, the Texas Freedom Caucus has issued letters to various parties, one being the very big law firm, Sidley Austin, essentially saying what's next, so that they plan to introduce legislation that could penalize people who assist Texans from leaving the state to seek abortions other places. The National Right to Life campaign has model legislation that attempts to penalize people helping minors leave states to seek abortions. So right now, there aren't laws on the books that have that extraterritorial effect. And there's reasons to think those laws have big constitutional problems, but that's not going to stop some states from trying to enact them.
That's what I was going to ask you about, because right now I can't travel anywhere in this country. who's going to stop a young woman from crossing a state line if that is unconstitutional?
I think that's, I mean, it's a great question because it's both the practical problem of enforcing a law like that and the legal problems of passing laws that have cross-border effects. So just taking the legal problems, we have a right to travel in this country.
Of course.
It's protected by the 14th Amendment. Now, after Dobbs, it could be that that right is up for grabs, but, you know, potentially not. We also don't allow states to burden interstate commerce under the Constitution. We guarantee people rights of privileges and immunities, another constitutional clause. We have rights in the Constitution that seek to permit us as Americans to travel from state to state. We take it for granted. I take it for granted that if gambling is illegal in my state, I'm not going to get into trouble if I go to Vegas for the weekend where gambling is legal. So there are reasons to believe that these laws have constitutional problems. The problem, though, is that these arguments haven't been really applied to abortion, except in a couple of cases, one before Roe, one in a state court. And some of these provisions, like privileges and immunities, haven't been developed really at all. And so it's not a closed question. There's not a sizable body of law in which you could point to and say, clearly unconstitutional. Courts will have to determine the answers to these questions.
So that sounds as though it's a long way in the future, because if a young woman, say, who lives in Texas, finds a doctor in Washington, D.C., where abortion remains legal, she finds that doctor, gets in touch with that doctor privately, say by phone, not by email, but by phone. The doctor agrees. She, at no point in her journey, has to say, I'm going to Washington for an abortion. What's to stop her from doing that now?
There's nothing to...
In addition to money, I was about to say.
Yeah, that's a wonderful point. I mean, what stops someone legally and what stops them because of money, childcare, time off of work? We know that 75%, more than 75% of the people who seek abortions live right at the federal income line. They're low-income people, they live below it. And so these are, you know, the resources are a real impediment to travel. We also know that the people who seek abortions, the majority of them already have children. And the reason they say that they are seeking to end the pregnancy is because they cannot afford the children they have. And so it's such a great point. But legally, states are really going to have to surveil and police activities if they are going to try to, just as you say, stop the person leaving from Texas to DC to seek an abortion. They don't do that now. There's nothing to stop someone other than resource limitations, time, and logistics. But I think that's one worry that I've expressed with my co-authors, is what does it mean for states to try? And one thing that's happened in anticipation of this new post-Roe, post-Dobbs world country, states have started legislating to protect providers, to protect the people who come to those states seeking legal services. So New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, California, a handful of states, governors issuing executive orders. These states have passed laws that have been called shield laws that essentially say to states like Missouri, who contemplated a bill that would have civilly punished through a private cause of action people providing abortions to Missouri residents out of state, say to Missouri, we're not going to comply with these lawsuits. We won't issue subpoenas. We will not comply with deposition requests. We won't extradite a provider providing legal services here in our state unless they're fleeing from justice. And some of those laws allow the provider to countersue if they are the subject of, you know, a lawsuit providing services that are legal in their own state.
So what you're suggesting is that we may be heading for a number of additional Supreme Court suits.
You know, one of the things that Justice Alito wrote in the Dobbs opinion was that one of the reasons to overturn Roe and Planned Parenthood versus Casey was that they enacted unworkable tests. They were complicated. Courts invited litigation. Courts applied those tests inconsistently. They deepened the debate about abortion in this country. But we are about to see much more debate because of the interstate conflict that is developing. And a law that impedes travel, I think that is something the Supreme Court could hear. How a federal law preempts state law in certain circumstances, that's a case the Supreme Court could hear. There's not going to be less litigation. There's going to be more.
Let's talk about medication and, for example, the abortion pill. Can states prevent people from accessing pills via a pharmacy or by mail?
Right now, the states that ban abortion ban pills. They ban all abortion, whether it's procedure or medication. But they penalize providers, and that's one of the reasons that with David Cohen and Greer Donnelly, we've written that's the crux of our argument of why states will start to target patients, because there will be a proliferation of mailed abortion pills. The FDA lifted a restriction on medication abortion in December that required patients to go to a healthcare facility, a clinic, a doctor's office, a hospital to pick up the first drug in a medication abortion. And now that that rule has been lifted, telehealth for medication abortion has become increasingly accepted with new providers providing online counseling and services, then following that with mailed pills. And those providers are operating in states where it's legal to do so, where they have permission to do so. They're licensed in those states to provide this care. But the reality is, I think that once pills are in the mail, they get very hard to track. You know, states are already contemplating legislation that bans the mailing, distribution, dissemination, use of pills, in anticipation of this new abortion care reality.
It strikes me that the Postal Inspection Service could become involved here, because delving into an individual's private mail to know what's in that perhaps plainly marked brown package is plainly illegal. So how are they going to do this? I mean, I used to work for the Postal Inspection Service. I know how serious the inspectors watch for material that should not be going through the mail. But again, let's take that young woman in Texas who gets online, who finds a distributor of RU486 or one of the other prescriptions that will terminate a pregnancy. What is to stop her from ordering that in Texas and having sent to her home?
I'd be very curious to hear about your experience working at those topics. It's one of the more complicated pieces of this, because as you well know, it's an independent federal agency and you need a warrant. You need a warrant to open someone's mail.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think about it as a kind of a spectrum of some states will pass laws and not necessarily invest. It's going to take significant time, money, effort, and will to enforce some of these laws. And some states won't do it, but some states will try. And we know who gets caught: people without resources, low-income people, people of color who are already surveilled by the state. But beyond that, just to your point, how would this work? We've already seen that Aid Access is an organization that works with providers outside of the U.S. and pharmacies outside of the U.S. And they offer medication abortion to folks wherever you live, whether or not the service is legal or not. And they've been subject to, you know, scrutiny. They've received a letter from the FDA telling them that they should not be operating in this way. But I use the example because when Texas passed SB 8 and it went into effect, and that's the law, the heartbeat statute that now Georgia mimics, but has the additional personhood element too. That statute creates, it's still law. It's still applied in the state. It creates a private cause of action for any individual to sue a Texas provider who they believe is in violation of the 6-week abortion ban. And when that law went into effect and it chilled abortion provision and shut down a number of clinics, the amount of demand on Aid Access skyrocketed. I mean, it was somewhere close to 185% increase in requests. So at Texas, as an example, people will order abortion pills online, and they will seek to receive them through the mail or through other means.
What about the pharmacies? What about pharmacies like CVS? Is there any indication that those large corporations may stop providing the pill simply because they are in the states that they are in, but in D.C., CVS will continue to provide the pill?
So that's a great point of clarification. So pharmacies and retail pharmacies do not carry medication abortion. When medication abortion is mailed, it is through an online pharmacy, Honeybee, and another online pharmacy who were given permission by the FDA because of after a court case in 2020 in Maryland, a federal district court in Maryland, which enjoined or halted that rule I described, requiring people to go in person to pick up the pills because of the pandemic, because it was applying Casey, which is now overturned. The court issued a judgment that said that rule is temporarily suspended. There's no reason for the rule. The evidence is clear that people don't need to pick this drug up at a facility. This is the only drug that people pick up somewhere, but they can take by themselves. So during the pandemic, to reduce patient-provider contact, this rule is going to be stopped. And there was litigation back and forth between ACOG, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and the FDA, which was during the Trump administration. And then the litigation resolved when the FDA itself suspended the rule and then permanently lifted it December 2021. That's all to say that as part of that decision, the FDA said that it would allow pharmacies to dispense medication abortion, pharmacies that are certified. But the FDA hasn't told us yet what the certification process is like for pharmacies. So now we're Honeybee and these two online pharmacies are still how medication abortion gets mailed in this country. But in the future, there will be a question of whether or not retail pharmacies like CVS or Walgreens, whether or not they'll carry abortion pills and be certified to do so under an FDA rule. early signals suggest that they are not not keen to do so.
They don't want to get involved in this process. But didn't you say earlier, or perhaps I misunderstood, didn't you say earlier that the FDA has already said to these online pharmacies that they should stop sending these pills into states that have banned them?
So that was that. Thank you for that. That's one instance. It was, and that's only, that was to aid access. This nonprofit group that works with providers and pharmacies outside of the US. So aid access is a model that, because jurisdiction is very hard to assert over the non-US providers and pharmacies, the FDA under the Trump administration sent a letter that said, you know, this is not permitted, but there's no way to really reach into another country to penalize those actors. What's happening in the US, where it's what's perfectly legal, is groups like Abortion on Demand, Choice, Just the Pill. These are providers who, some of them have brick and mortar services as well. They work in clinics or medical offices, but some of them are entirely virtual. Abortion on Demand is a large scale, entirely virtual clinic. And that that operates in states where teleabortion, telehealth for abortion is legal. They do not operate in states like Texas.
Do any of the abortion pill providers come from countries which may be suspect? For example, from China, do we know that those pills are not only efficacious, but safe?
So I don't believe that Aid Access uses providers or pharmacies in China, but I do believe that it's run by a doctor, Rebecca Gromberts. She's been working in this space for decades. She is the person who, if you remember, started Women on Waves, that had the ship that would be in international waters. And but she, I think, works very closely with very select folks, and I don't want to speak to the ins and outs of their operations because I just don't know them. But I think that, you know, with instruction, of course, always improves efficacy and safety, but that medication abortion is very safe and is very effective. And that's part of the reason why the FDA lifted the rule, is because there was just copious evidence that before 10 weeks of pregnancy, people do not need a physical encounter with a provider in order to safely end a pregnancy.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Rachel Rebuchet, interim dean and professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. Moving on to what you mentioned earlier, tell me about the spread of bills that define life at conception. How in the world can anyone know that one is pregnant at conception?
There's the issue of, you know, how would you know if you're pregnant? What does this mean for miscarriage? What does it mean for pregnancies that end? Ectopic pregnancies, there's been a lot of confusion around, outside of the personhood context, a lot of confusion around how new state laws or newly enforced state laws intersect with pregnancy loss. Does that people being turned away from hospitals because they are experiencing miscarriage, but the pregnancy is not ended? And so providers, you know, the people delivering that care don't know if they will be subject to punishment because they're ending a pregnancy. How do exceptions for medical emergency, for life, for health, how are they implemented? How are they interpreted? Personhood makes those questions even more complicated because if there's personhood from the moment of conception, what's your legal responsibility from the moment of conception? And what does that mean for the person who's pregnant? What does that mean for people treating the pregnant person? You know, it's just, I saw recently a bill proposed for child support from the moment of conception for the other. And so, you know, so there's just going to be really fascinating set of questions. We already see that some of the abortion bans have had direct impact on the fertility industry. When people have IVF, often they implant more than one embryo.
Yes.
Because often the only one embryo will remain viable and turn into a pregnancy. Where does that sit if another embryo is extracted because it's not a viable pregnancy? Where that the intersection there with personhood and abortion laws is I think really complicated.
I read recently about a woman who had an ectopic pregnancy, and just as you indicated, the doctors refused to treat her because they were concerned they would be charged with providing an abortion. I mean, an ectopic pregnancy could kill a woman.
I think that, I think that we're going to see people die because of because of this type of issue.
So this too is certainly likely to impact the entire legal landscape.
I think so. I think that there is, it's very complicated.
Yes.
It's fast changing. It hasn't been a month since Dobbs. I mean, just look at everything, you know, just in weeks, what we've witnessed. I think legal and access questions will become even more complicated.
Rachel, what about birth control pills? Is there an indication here that what those who are totally against abortion would like to eliminate access to birth control pills? Are we nearing that point as well?
You know, it's a tough question because now, in 2022, in July 2022, the Constitution still protects right to use birth control for married people under Griswold, for single people under Eisenstadt, two cases that preceded Roe. And I think the worry that I've heard, or the worry for a lot of folks, is that the kind of reasoning that Justice Alito used in Dobbs and the concurrence written by Justice Thomas, those, you know, for Alito suggests, for Thomas explicit, that those rights could be revisited. And for the majority opinion in Dobbs, it's, you know, Justice Alito, to be clear, it says maybe three times, this is not about any other right. This is just about abortion. We are only overturning constitutional protection for abortion. But the concurrence that Justice Thomas wrote, you know, basically says, well, why? Well, you know, are contraceptives part of the nation's history and part of the text of the Constitution? So there's the concern that, you know, given the opportunity, there might be willingness to revisit constitutional protection for birth control. And if that returns to the states, then states could it write laws that limit or exclude certain forms of birth control or place other restrictions on it or ban it altogether.
Such as IUDs, for example.
Such as IUDs, which, you know, there is an ongoing debate about. You know, one thing that I think has been true about this conversation is that the definition of abortion and its shifting nature, that some IUDs, emergency contraception, you know, a willingness to try to include these things as abortion. But if states can ban contraceptives, of course, they don't need to fit those things into a definition of abortion. They could just legislate for IUDs or for plan B.
Rachel, it seems that what Justice Thomas is trying to get to is to say that sex between two adults or sex at all should only be allowed in marriage.
If you start to unravel 14th Amendment fundamental rights that are part of the due process clause, you start to unravel lots of things,
yes.
Lots
yes.
of freedoms yes. that we enjoy. It's not just birth control, but as you've just mentioned, sexual intimacy, who you're intimate with who, you know, the marriage, who you can marry, parental rights, your right to direct the education of your children, decide who gets visitation rights, and like there's a whole cluster of rights that are implicated. And I wonder how the court then draws those lines about which rights are part of the Constitution and which rights are not.
I'm wondering about what President Biden can do in the face of these individual state laws, what he personally can do. He's trying to work on climate change now with some presidential executive order. Is the same possible in regard to the issues we've been talking about?
I think it is. I think there are things that the Biden administration can do and that the president can lead. We saw the executive order that he announced, and there was a piece of that I think is really important, which is directing Health and Human Services to do essentially an audit, and in a month, in 30 days, to indicate what the agency can do to help promote access to gather information, to help people understand this complicated legal landscape we're in. I think that the Biden administration could direct all agencies to do that. You know, if we're worried about data tracking and we're worried about information, what could the FTC do? What could, I think that's a piece of it. And then I think there are some measures that the Biden administration could pursue that it's signaled that it's willing to do, you know, telling states, hey, we have a federal law that requires people to deliver emergency care in an ER, not to quote patient dump, sending a patient who might be expensive to another facility. So as part of that law, if someone presents and they have a medical emergency that requires abortion, you know, your duty to stabilize that patient is a federal duty, and it preempts what states say. There are broader and bigger preemption arguments around medication abortion itself, about the FDA being the final word on efficacy and safety of abortion pills, not states. And then there's been calls for the Biden administration to declare a public health emergency. So there are a range of things that the administration can do, from both legal arguments to resource, practical, logistical support.
I have one more question. I know you have to leave us shortly. What about the constitutionality of a countrywide ban on abortion?
That's so interesting, because if Congress passed a nationwide ban on abortion, that would preempt states that seek to protect abortion rights. And that law would govern. And there could be constitutional arguments to make if the ban is too narrow. You could see that is happening in states. State constitutions being the way in which people are arguing that bans go too far, or they don't have exceptions, or that state constitutions have rights to privacy or bodily autonomy and protect abortion. Similar arguments might be made under the federal constitution. A national abortion ban would preempt state laws seeking to protect abortion. And there could be arguments there too about whether or not the federal government had gone past, you know, what was the powers and all that. The same for a national right to abortion. So the Women's Health Protection Act, which passed the House but didn't make it out of the Senate, would create a national right to provide abortion and to receive abortion care. And that would preempt states that seek to ban abortion. So without a floor of constitutional protection at the federal level, the federal constitution, or without national legislation, we're going to see this patchwork of legality across the country.
Rachel, thank you so much for being with us. This is such a complicated issue, and you've been so helpful in explaining this to us.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for having me on.
That was Rachel Rabuchet, interim dean and professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Dantenhauser. Thanks for listening, all. Please stay well. I'm Diane Reed.